okay, so many people say to me, like, oh, you know, I felt so bad. I really needed time off work that I thought about, you know, just getting into an accident, getting a physical injury that would allow me to have time off, but could not admit that I have a mental health problem that I need time off for. So it's okay to break your leg and be treated for that and have time off. And that's a really sad state of affairs, but very, very common. And so it just goes to show how people look at mental.
Hi everyone, I'm Laura, and you are listening to episode 8 of Mind Brew Chats, honest conversations about mental health, well-being, and life. In this episode, we'll be talking about the mental health of healthcare workers, a subject that's very close to my heart and to my work. We'll be dividing this episode into two segments of roughly 40 minutes each. In the first half, we talk about how the pandemic affected the healthcare sector in Malaysia, Australia, and UK, as well as the mental health challenges that have affected healthcare workers way before the pandemic started. In the second half, we dive deep into the mental health stigma that healthcare workers, especially doctors, face when seeking help for mental health issues. And as a little bonus, we also talk about how an ultramarathoner survived a year cooped up under lockdown. We have two guests today, Dr. Amelia Low, an emergency medicine doctor in Melbourne, and Dr. Trevor Lim, a public health specialist in Sabah. Amelia and I were schoolmates and classmates since primary school, and I haven't seen her for close to a decade. She escaped the NHS in the UK and now reluctantly calls Australia home. She loves to travel, but is currently trapped in Melbourne due to this blight of a pandemic. Her preferred element is water, and when not in scrubs, you can find her swimming, floating, diving, surfing, blowing bubbles, pretending to be a whale, etc. Now, as for Dr. Trevor, he started his career in public health medicine in Lahad Datu Sabah, just in time for the start of the pandemic and MCO in Malaysia. He's originally from Peninsula Malaysia, but has been serving in Sabah and Sarawak since 2009. What's also really interesting about Trevor is that he loves to run a lot, as in insanely long distances that normal human beings would not think of attempting without a car. His preferred downtime activities are training for and competing in ultra trail challenges up to 100 kilometers. But due to the pandemic and no sporting events are allowed, Trevor has resorted to running marathons around his office. I'm really excited to dive into conversation with our two guests today, so let's get started. Hi Amelia, hi Trevor, welcome to Mind Brew Chats. It's about 7:30 p.m. here in Malaysia and 9:30 p.m. in Melbourne. How are the two of you today? How have you been?
I'm a bit nervous to be here, but happy that you asked me to participate in this. Mental health is obviously one of those things I'm quite passionate about, so very happy to talk about all that here today. How am I doing today? I'm tired. I finished work. I have to work again tomorrow. That's how I feel.
Thank you, Amelia, for making time to brief us today on this intercontinental episode. And I've got to say, it feels kind of weird because I've not heard your voice for close to a decade, and you still sound exactly the same.
So do you.
What about you, Trevor?
Thanks for inviting me, Laura. I'm good, actually. I'm quite fine, but I don't have so many people to talk to because of the movement control order recently, except for work. Yeah, thanks for inviting again.
I feel you. For those of us who have been living in countries or areas that have been under lockdown for extended periods, and Malaysia is currently under another MCO for an indefinite period of time, our lives have just consisted of work, more work, home, work, and most of it is spent staring at the screen of some sort. Now, let's just dive straight into it. Do you remember the first time you heard about this coronavirus situation? And did you have any idea at all that it would become as bad as it is now? I remember it was the start of 2020. We started hearing news about this worrying new virus emerging from Wuhan, China. And during Chinese New Year 2020, it was all my relatives talked about. At the time, I didn't pay much attention. I was really busy with all the things that I had planned to do for the year. I didn't think much of it. I thought that, yeah, it sounds bad, but I think it's just gonna go away soon, just like all the other viruses have, and it's not gonna get bad. And look where we are now.
Yeah, for me actually, I still managed to go back to celebrate the Chinese New Year last year. Before, even though there's some few cases from coming in from Singapore at Johor, but after I went back to Lahad Datu in March, there was the first case in Sabah at Tawau, and because of a congregation of events in the Sri Petaling Mosque, so there are a lot of participants who went there and came back to Sabah, and we started our. We started our work controlling the outbreaks in Sabah. And actually, during that time, I had an event on that weekend. I already prepared myself, all my gears, I already packed up and waiting to go. And suddenly, things turned up, and then I can't leave my boss alone. So I went to run. So I just forfeited the running events and do what I'm supposed to do, which is to test and trace and isolate all these person under investigation at the point of time.
Did you ever think that things would get this bad? Did you even have the slightest premonition that this could get bad?
At the very beginning, because this is something new, right? So we have a lot to learn, and by the time we get more information about it, we thought that we can handle it until some events eventually make it worse, especially in Sabah. To be honest, we already gave our professional and technical opinions to the relevant people in power, but they choose to decide in another way, which causes waves after waves now.
That sounds like an incredibly frustrating experience for the experts who were, well, actually doing their job, preparing expert advice and strategies. But that being said, COVID was very new. It was a completely unprecedented situation. And the whole world was scrambling on a daily basis to find ways to contain it, to deal with it. I don't think anyone could have imagined that things would get this bad. What about you, Emilia? Where were you the first time you heard about COVID?
So I don't remember where I was particularly the first time I heard it, but I remember it was like a bit of news trickling through a few cases, and then I had the same sort of early reaction as you. So it's going to be something that's maybe confined to a small area. You know, maybe it might be like SARS. It might spread a bit around there, but we'd be okay, and we have to manage if, you know, people come in from countries like China. And that was at the start where we did have, you know, travelers from China and we're isolating them, and no one really took it very seriously at the start. I think everyone had the same kind of, we know how things can get bad. We've, you know, studied about it, like public health and all that. It's all in theory there. And we've all been talking about, you know, there'll be a big flu pandemic at some point, but no one really realized that this is it. We're going to be facing this situation that we're in now. And it's quite funny if you look back, looking at my Facebook posts as well. It was like at the start of the pandemic, it was like, oh, calm down, everyone. This is, we're not in the apocalypse. Now I'm eating my words, so there you go.
For those in our audience who are not familiar with the terms emergency, registrar, and public health medicine, could you describe in brief what are the daily tasks and responsibilities of an emergency medicine doctor and a public health specialist, and how did this change as the pandemic unfolded?
So from a day-to-day basis, I guess it's different terms for different countries. So emergency registrar here just means that you're not fully a specialist. So you're either in training and in the progress of getting to becoming a specialist or pakar. Usually the registrars are like the workhorse of the emergency department. So we see the majority of patients come in, and our job is to see whatever comes through the door, stabilize patients, either send them home or admit them to, you know, a ward or intensive care. And then specifically my role at the time, so I was and still am working in a major hospital in Melbourne. And so busy emergency department, a big trauma center, which is busy normally. And obviously with the pandemic, things just got a lot busier. In terms of the actual, when the pandemic started, I was in a leadership role as a senior registrar, and my role was clinical operations. So it's just a fancy name of, I guess, communicating changes to how we're doing things. And that was a role before the pandemic started. So it kind of shifted to mainly communicating between junior medical staff and the leadership group about what the changes were, what the concerns were from, I guess, the more junior doctors and staff, and then communicating from the top end down as well to make sure everyone was happy what was going on. And you can imagine there's a lot of information constantly changing because we're all learning at the same time. No one knows very much about at that point, what the disease was like and what we should treat it with and how it would progress. And so to give an example, I'm sure Trevor will have a lot more kind of experience on this end, but we have an infection prevention guideline that tells you, you know, what to do from when a patient comes in, who gets tested, and then how we isolate them, and then how to manage them on the ward. And we're now down to version 54. So that's how many we've gone through in terms of changes.
I think it's the same in Malaysia. We have about 20 old versions now as well.
I'm curious, though. This is a bit of a off topic, but we have dealt with really infectious diseases before. We have had Ebola, SARS, MERS. Weren't those protocols kind of already in place, and why did you have to again adapt just to deal with COVID?
I think from our point of view in emergency, it was a lot of uncertainty and not a lot of information about how COVID was transmitted. There was a lot of debate at the start. Is it airborne, is it droplet? And then there was a lot of confusion about what sort of PPE we should be wearing to protect ourselves, the patients. I guess it was not established in terms of how we needed to do things because there's not a lot of information. And even among, you know, like WHO and in different countries, there was still a lot of disagreement about what we should be doing. And I'll be keen to hear what Trevor thinks about that side of things.
I think mainly because it's something new, and the thing about COVID is a lot of people don't know that they have it because they are asymptomatic. That's a very, very big challenge for us to isolate or quarantine all these close contacts and also personal under investigation. So I think the asymptomatic makes things much, much worse. Yeah. Because people tend to think they are healthy, they are normal, and they don't obey to the quarantine orders, and eventually the things will spread.
So I imagine that makes your job as a public health specialist, and correct me if I'm wrong, but you started your career in public medicine just in time for the pandemic. Is that correct? How did that feel like?
Yeah, you can say so, because I graduated, I finished my public health program in August 2019. I think after 6 months, this thing showed up, and we really can put things into use. And actually, public health specialty in Malaysia is not well known. I think a lot of people in the public doesn't know about public health medicine. Actually, in short, is public health medicine deals with challenges and also health problems outside of the hospital. It's part of preventive medicine, and we try to make sure the people, the population health is in good hands and don't end up in hospital or don't end up with complications. During this pandemic, what I did was mostly more of a planning and managing the contacts, the cases, and where to put them. And also public health specialty also, we need to deal with other agencies, because when we are dealing with this pandemic, we can't be working alone actually. We really don't have the capacity to handle the whole pandemic on ourselves. I mean, by Ministry of Health, because we really don't have the manpower, not enough manpower. We don't have enough resources. We need to pull everything together and we need to share the burden with other agencies. That is the part where public health takes place, where we will have meetings with other agencies in the area or division outbreak management committee. And we will convey the message to the state outbreak committee to advise them on what should be done next.
Both of your jobs sound incredibly stressful and exhausting. It's been your life for, what, a year and a half now? For Malaysia, our first case of COVID landed in January 2020. Our MCO, or lockdown, started in March 2020. And it's been a constant cycle of ups and downs, and mostly downs, but some ups as well since then. Everyone is exhausted. So for our listeners, please continue to practice social distancing as much as you possibly can. Get vaccinated as soon as possible and stay safe. Give our healthcare workers a break. They really need it.
I always feel very uncomfortable when people go, look at the frontliners, they're working so hard. I just have to say there's a caveat of we in Australia have been very lucky. I think in terms of the way the pandemic has unfolded here and also how the different states and government have approached trying to prevent it from getting worse. I think there's some things that I don't necessarily agree with in terms of how the government works, you know, keeping Australians out of Australia to try and stop COVID from coming in. But I think we've been very, very lucky because at the start, there was a lot of support from the public to just get us locked down very early on, try and just stop it from spreading. And all the different states had their own approaches. So when we say it was busy at the start, it was a different sort of busy. It was never that, I think we prepared for a really big influx of sick patients that we never really got at the early part of the pandemic. I mean, it was a lot of preparation, but also a very weird period of maybe a month or two where people were scared to come to the hospital. And the emergency departments were the quietest that had ever been, that I've ever seen in my life. So it was a different sort of busy, different sort of stressful, because we were preparing and trying to work out what was changing and how we should manage things. And there was like building works and expanding and all that. But it wasn't like a hectic non-stop, which it might have been, I think, for a lot of other countries, Malaysia included.
So it's really interesting to see how the pandemic was handled from the perspective of doctors practicing in different specialties and in different localities. Obviously, no country can claim to have handled the pandemic perfectly. Everyone suffered some sort of collateral damage. Now, the other day, I heard something on Simon Sinek's podcast that really resonated with me. The podcast is called A Bit of Optimism, and I highly recommend it, by the way. I'm going to put the link in the show notes so that you can check it out if you're interested. On that episode, there was this US Army general. He said that the COVID pandemic was like being in a combat situation. You have the shared experience of being in a high stress situation. You have the life or death aspect of it, and you have the many uncertainties associated with being in that situation. That's exactly what we are going through. Most civilians would never be in a combat situation, but the entire world is now living in a pandemic. We don't know when it's going to end. We don't know what things are going to change next. We are fearful for our lives as well as that of our loved ones who are high risk. And some of us may have already lost loved ones to the virus. So it is like we are living in a combat situation. Now, what was interesting is he mentioned soldiers are trained to deal with that stress by compartmentalizing it. This means they learn to detach themselves from the emotions of that present moment. They are trained to be really mission focused on tasks at hand, so they can still complete their mission even though there's this trauma of seeing their comrades injured or killed, and also the stress of fearing for your own life. But the thing is, eventually you have to still deal with that trauma and stress. There is no way you can compartmentalize it forever. It's going to come out sooner or later. And this also refers to the mental health pandemic that is predicted to come or is already happening parallel to and overlapping with the current COVID pandemic. So I'm curious, what was the experience for you after hearing, you know, me talking about this combat situation analogy? Was it similar or was there something different? I'll start first. For me, I think I dealt with it by being very mission focused. When the news came, the MCO started, we were very busy at work coming up with contingency plans. We had to put in place standard operating procedures, SOPs. We had to make sure that we continued to deliver patient care in a way that was safe for the patients as well as for our own staff. At the same time, I was really worried about my family as well, because there were several high-risk individuals. It was just constant. I didn't process anything. I was just too tired. It was just go, 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 go. To top all of that off, in July, my workplace became a cluster and we were in lockdown for 2 weeks. My problem-solving brain went into overdrive. It was like, how do we keep things running? We still have, you know, patients to take care of. I had to make sure that my staff was supported and my own family had to be reassured as well, because they were worried about me. It wasn't until the end of the year when things started getting better and it was a bit more normal, I had time to sit down and actually process everything. The grief, the loss, the everything. And I shut down for a while. What was the experience like for you?
For me, when the start of this pandemic, I was also, because it's something new, so was very focused on the task to control the outbreak. Really spend a lot of time and keep on reading new materials and new information, and also do what we can and sit in the meeting and try to learn as much as I can from other division or other district as well. And that's what we discuss in the daily meetings with our state director here. So we discuss on how to manage, and we share our ideas and see what's the best to manage the outbreak at the different districts. I did work a lot and I did work very hard thinking that we can contain the outbreak actually at the very beginning. Yes, and actually at my office, I think it's because my office has a stockpile of the nasal swab. That's why we get most of the swab test result first. That's how it unfolded the whole thing in Sabah actually. So we are one of the first district to have to deal with the big surge of the cases there. And we managed to trace and track down all these close contacts and eventually managed to quarantine them and isolate them. And I think we did pretty well, and the curve actually really slowed down very much. But eventually, I think I get tired, even the people also get tired with the movement control orders. And for information, I think a lot of people in Sabah, they are on daily wages. So when they lost their income due to quarantine, they got fired, and economy is not so well at those areas. So eventually all these things contributed to all these people. They don't really obey or follow what being prescribed or being asked to do. Like, they don't wear masks, they don't practice distancing. So at the end of the day, I feel tired too, because people are not taking it seriously. And then no matter how much I do or my team do, the things just the people just don't follow, and eventually I can't do much actually. So I after that I just focus on what I can control, and what I can't control I really just leave it. If not, I will very stressed out. Like.
Oh, about that. If you spend enough time on social media, you will find a lot of people venting their frustration at people who, I believe the term coined was COVIDiots, who don't comply to health guidelines, who don't practice social distancing, and who may not even believe that COVID is real or really that serious. How do you, as healthcare workers, manage your frustration and your anger at these kinds of people and not take it out on your patients?
Having a mask to hide your facial expressions helps quite a lot.
Having the mask is really useful. I don't always remember that, you know, I can't roll my eyes or look annoyed when something happens at work. So yes, the mask is definitely useful. What about you, Trevor? You just talked about how frustrating it was to be doing your job. But in a way, it was completely understandable why people did not continue to comply with the lockdown SOPs. Because it was extended again and again. And people need to earn a living. They need to feed their families. And as you so rightfully pointed out, this is especially true for those who are earning a daily wage, those in the B40 income group. It wasn't just pure ignorance or defiance that caused them to behave the way that they did.
Yeah, I try to think on their behalf and change my mindset a bit. And I know we can't force people to do what they don't want to do. What I can do is just educate. And if they don't want to do, eventually they get infected. And some, even there's some stories in our quarantine center. Some quarantines, because in the quarantine centers, they are different from different families, people from different families. So they are separated in different rooms. When they see, because we have another of a confirmed cases block in opposite of the quarantine center. So they said, I'd rather go to the confirmed cases block because I can move around. I can interact with the people around. I was like, okay, we just listen. And because they are very frustrated of being quarantined alone in the room, and there's no support there actually, and there's not much of network there. Our network is pretty bad in Sabah, so they can't online, and they got nowhere to vent out their frustration actually. And then some even sheltered in the quarantine center and such. I try to understand them and try to think on their behalf. It makes me feel better in that sense that they did it because they have no other choice.
So it's really about putting yourself into that person's position and having empathy for them, right? And having been in that position of self-isolating myself, I definitely know that it's not easy. You are cut off from human interaction. You are disconnected from your loved ones and family. And at the same time, in quarantine, you are probably waiting for your own swab results as well. And that is absolute torture. Even if you're not worried for yourself, you think that, oh, you know, I'm young, I'm healthy, COVID's got nothing on me. But you will be worried about the people that you have come into contact with, maybe your parents or someone else in your network who is high risk. What if you accidentally infected them? And that places a lot of mental stress on the person being quarantined or who is self-isolating. What about you, Amelia? What was your experience with the pandemic and how did you handle it?
I think what you're talking about with the mental health side of things, I'll talk a bit more about my own experience later. But I think what Trevor was saying about how patients or the public are, you know, frustrating to us because we are like, why aren't you following your MCO or SOPs? Why aren't you just listening to what we're saying? And I think over here as well, especially because we did have a very long lockdown, so very strict, very long lockdown, people couldn't leave apart from if you had to go to work in like a essential worker situation. Otherwise, you were stuck in your house working from home. If you could, you could go out 5 kilometers distance from your house is the limit. I think if you like 1 hour or 2 hours a day to exercise was that's what you could do. And then that impact on people who, as Trevor was saying, depend on a daily wage. The same thing here as well. A lot of people lost their jobs. And we saw that even early on in the pandemic, with patients coming in and almost everyone was like, someone's lost their job. I'm jobless now, you know, and all the mental health presentations were just escalating as well. So definitely very quickly saw the effect of that. And it's not so much like people don't want to follow the rules, but sometimes they can't, they have to go to work. So they will lie and say, I don't have symptoms, or, you know, it's just a cold. I've got to pay for my bills. I've got to get food for my family and, you know, just carry on. So it's frustrating, I think, for us on one end to see that and then go, oh, you know, blame them for spreading it around and get things getting worse. But definitely what you're saying about putting yourself in their shoes and understanding where they're coming from, and I guess trying to communicate to them in a way that they understand why and how, trying to find the support that is available for them as well. And from a personal point of view, I think early on, it was very similar to you. So very action oriented. It was a lot of things to do to try and prepare. And there was a lot of meetings, you know, it's like 3 times a week I had to go to meetings to try and work out what was changing. And there was a lot of drills and things at work, you know, how are we going to manage patients who are coming in and isolating and being safe. And so there's a lot of stuff to do at the start, and really probably towards the end of the year, like yourself as well, you had a bit more time, I guess, for things to catch up to you. And I think I've always struggled with kind of depression on and off, but I'd gotten to a stage where it'd been pretty stable for quite a while. And it kind of just crept up on me as well by the end of the year. And I think a lot of it was also around just not being able to do things I would normally do to keep myself sane and not, you know, shouting at patients. And so, yeah, so things like what I would normally do, be getting out the house, you know, exercising and being in the water somewhere is always good for me. And so all that was just off limits for most of the year. I think probably there was a couple of months towards the end of the year where things were tough. Things weren't tough at work, as in things were not escalating badly, but it's more just, I guess, things building up and then catching up, having time to then look at how things are going and then struggling from that point of view.
Thank you, Amelia, for sharing your experience with us. It certainly sounded like you were experiencing burnout at the time. I would even go so far to say that you were having some level of low-grade depression. And there's been a lot of noise about healthcare worker burnout during this pandemic. There's been a lot of research studies, there's been a lot of articles. Just last week, a Malaysian study was released which reported that over 50% of healthcare workers surveyed reported very high levels of burnout. And this includes pharmacists, nurses, laboratory technicians, and not just doctors. But the thing is, working in healthcare, especially for doctors, is a very high stress environment. It's very high pressure. And burnout is not something new. It is something that's always been there. It's just that COVID exacerbated an existing issue. So would you say that you are burnout at this point in time? Or were you burnout at some point in the past 1.5 years that we've been battling the pandemic?
I think for me, I'm not burnout at the moment, but I did burn out when I was at Lahad Datu managing the outbreak there, because I was working every day, I think more than 12 hours, 16 hours. Maybe sometimes like my meetings is until midnight with the state director. And then the next day you need to go to work again at 8 and get all the things sorted out. So at that point of time, yes, I did feel very, very tired and burnout. And like Emilia said, you can't do what you usually do to release your stress. And that actually contributed to the burnout. And the other thing is, I think in Malaysia, the burnout is it's only on papers, and I don't really feel that there's much intervention because we have limited human resources. So sometimes it's very hard to let a frontliner goes on a long leave until they recover with their mental health before they come back to provide their services. So that is very hard to do in Malaysia. I'm not sure about Australia because I think Australia has a better understanding on the mental health, and I think the benefits of mental health is, I feel it's better from my personal perspective.
In that same article, it was actually reported that the Ministry of Health has put in place a number of interventions to prevent burnout in our healthcare frontliners. Among them is a hotline that's run by both Mercy Malaysia and the Ministry of Health Malaysia that frontliners can go to get psychological first aid and emotional support. And every state has a mental health and psychosocial support services center that coordinates these services for frontliners as well as members of the public and persons who are under quarantine. How effective were these interventions? Did you see them at ground level in Sabah?
In Sabah, there is the psychosocial first aid and so psychosocial health supports. And also, we were asked to do this dust test periodically, every 3 months or 6 months or so. But whenever I want to fill up the questionnaire, I feel stressed up already. So so basically, I'll just I'll do it when I'm very, very free, when I feel better. Yeah, if not, I wouldn't touch it until the very last minute. And to be honest, I didn't engage with any of the psychosocial hotline or support because I personally think I still can handle it, but just that finding which kind of way to handle it, that's the issue actually. And I think for mental health, you cannot intervene for everybody using the similar ways because everybody treats the stress, treats burnout differently. So I'm not sure whether hotline or psychosocial first aid, it does help. I think it's to a certain extent only. That's my personal opinion.
I agree that mental health interventions are not a one-size-fits-all. They have to be very individualized according to what a person needs or what they are comfortable with. What about you, Amelia?
I think from the burnout side of things, if I look back at last year, I don't think I would call that really burnout as in, I've definitely been burnt out before. I've had a very clear period when I left the UK where I was really burnt out and was considering even just quitting and changing career. And that's in part because of like the NHS and being understaffed and just the whole cycle of that. I think it's probably a bit similar to the situation you're describing in Malaysia where you don't have enough people, you feel bad if you call in sick because you know that someone else has to take up the slack for you, and then it's just a cycle, you're overworked, you're staying late, don't really have energy to look after yourself outside of work, and then it just goes into this whole cycle. So I've definitely been through that when I left the UK. And you're right, it is a lot better in Australia in terms of the awareness of the mental health issues in healthcare professionals, but also just because the staffing is better, you can take time off, and it's not frowned upon for you to take time off because you have a mental health issue. And because there's enough staffing to cover sick leave and all that, it's less of an issue to say, you know, I have to push through even though I'm really struggling. And there are supports similar to what you're describing, you know, that every hospital has an employee support program. The uptake of that is very variable. I think people, especially doctors or healthcare workers, are very resistant in seeking help, especially if it's linked to your organization where you work as well. Even though it's clearly, you know, this is confidential, no one's going to tell your boss that, you know, you're struggling unless there's an actual issue with your work performance that's dangerous. So you don't have to disclose any of that routinely. I think, but doctors are still very paranoid about this situation, especially things like, oh, people will know. And so there are resources outside of your own organization as well. So statewide, there's different kind of doctors' health programs that you can go to that's confidential to seek either for physical health as well, but mostly mental health issues. But I really don't know what the uptake is, because my feeling from personal experience is that most doctors I know are very, very resistant to asking for help. And a lot of us are like, we can deal with it ourselves, you know. Maybe I can run an ultra marathon out of my depression or swim my way out of it. And I'm guilty of that myself as well. So it's hard. It's one, it's the resources of people being available to for you to be able to take time off. So that's contributing to the burnout. And then two, you've got to be willing to seek help as well. And then the third thing is that you need to know where to get that help from. So it's a couple of things contributing to that burnout situation.
Now, this mental health stigma, this shame in admitting that you need help in healthcare workers is such an important subject. We're going to explore this a bit more in the second part of our podcast today. Mental health stigma extends across board. It just doesn't just apply to doctors. It also applies to nurses and pharmacists and society in general. I believe there's a lot of both scientific and anecdotal data to back this up. Just to give you an example, the Mental Health Association of Sarawak ran a social media campaign last year, and it's actually still ongoing. So I'm going to put a link to in the show notes to this as well. It was called hashtag Kesa Kame, which in Sarawakian Malay means my story. And we had submissions from doctors and nurses who talked about being scared to seek help in the organization because of this issue of confidentiality. And the people who are planning and running these services, they need to be highly aware that confidentiality is, or rather the fear of confidentiality breach, is a major barrier to those who should be seeking help. And hopefully modifications can be done to allay these fears and make the service more attractive to the people who need them. Well, speaking of ultramarathons, I'm interested to see how someone who runs insanely long distances coped with an entire year, or rather year and a half really, of not being able to run. How have you been?
I've been very bad, actually. I gained weight. Yeah, at the very beginning of the pandemic, when I still had the stamina, I actually still ran a marathon around my office before I start to work. Yeah, but after that, it goes down the drain.
You can't see us now because there's no video. But Emilia and I are both shaking our heads. Trying to imagine Trevor running around his office and a marathon that's like, what, 42 kilometers? Wow.
Because I got nothing better to do at that point of time. And I just want to do it when I still have the stamina to do it, actually.
Just to clarify, was that in your office building or around your office building?
Around my office building.
Okay, it's a 200
meter loop, yeah.
I was imagining like going round and round in this little room.
I think someone actually did that, right? Yeah. In quarantine, they ran in their hotel room or something.
One of my friends, he did, I think, almost 100 kilometer indoor, spinning around the house areas. That's it. I couldn't do that. After that, I don't really keep on to my training programs, because usually I will have certain programs event oriented. The last event I ran was on last March in Kuching Ultra Marathon. I did a 70 kilometer ultra marathon. After that, I didn't do anything else. I just do my own run at the moment, just to maintain my physical health status, and that's about it. I'm not doing anything crazy at the moment.
What's the longest distance that you've ever run?
I think the event is 100 kilometer, but the actual distance is about 110. Yeah, it took me about almost 29 hours.
How does a human being keep running for 29 hours and not give up? What keeps you going in that 29 hours?
The finishing line. it's not like I keep on running 29 hours. It's like we do rest, and because this 100 kilometers is in the trail, so I really sometimes we really needed to rest or just a power nap, and we need to do that. It's not like continuous 29 hours. I just want to finish as soon as possible, as fast as possible.
Any thoughts about that, Amelia, given your distaste for running?
I'm still trying to wrap my head around the concept of running like 100Ks. That's crazy to me. It's just, well, I always think of running, like I have this perception of running being like something really good. Like I imagine I would really enjoy it. And then every time I try it, I realize, why am I doing this to myself? And then I'm like, is there really a runner's high, or is this just a myth that people perpetuate because they like themselves? So I think on and off, I've tried running and always failed after a while. And I tried that last year as well when I couldn't do any other exercise. I was like, all right, I'm gonna try and run in this 5 kilometer radius. I think that lasted maybe 2 weeks. That's probably the longest I've ever run. And where I live is very, it's not really hills, but to me, it feels like I'm running up mountains. I'm just like, why? Why isn't this ending? So yeah, it's hard for me to understand, but I definitely understand the, exercising as a form of, you know, de-stressing.
Yeah.
I always tell this story about probably one of the times I started running here. I was like, all right, I'm going to do a run today. And I ran to the end of the road and a bit further. I have a family member, relatives living not very far away. So I ended up almost passing out outside their door. I went in, and then we ended up ordering KFC. And then the worst thing about that whole situation is they then drove me home. So that was my running attempt at running. And I haven't really been much more successful in that sense. So really admire what you do. Cannot understand it.
To salvage what remains of Amelia's reputation, she's actually very fit. This is a woman who climbs mountains. I think you climbed quite a few mountains and you made it to the top and back without having to be carried. So you're reasonably fit in my book. Some people do consider running a form of meditation. That's why they like doing it. Is this what it's like? What goes on in your head when you're running 100 kilometers apart from that finishing line?
During those running, actually, I don't think much, because usually if I join an event, I usually will plan out and I have a certain target to hit and certain timing to hit, and I will make sure I will hit a certain timing at that point of time. So I'm thinking a lot on what we call this, on hitting the targets, just small targets, a little by little, and eventually finish the race. If I'm running for training, I got nothing to think about. Usually I just count numbers and count my breathings as part of my meditation, because I don't think of anything else, actually.
So it's a form of rest for your mind as well. Like, yeah, you've got all these worries, you've got all these things that you have to do. But yeah, when you are running, you don't think about those things. Your mind is kind very of simple. At peace.
Yes, very simple and nothing much, just numbers, just counting, just breathing, and that's, and just moving one leg in front of another, one step at a time.
And that's almost like mindfulness, what mindfulness is, right? Being really grounded in the present, being conscious of your breathing and what's happening then and there. Nothing yes. else matters.
Yes.
Have you ever been injured during a race and struggled to like finish, or do you just drop out? Has that ever happened for you?
I never drop out, but I did injure during training and during preparation towards a race. At that point of time, I wasn't sure what I was suffering from, and I went to see specialists, I went to see physio, I went to see chiro. I did a lot of different methods and trying to get well as soon as possible so that I can run again. Because when I don't run, I feel very anxious, agitated. Because I was so used to the happy hormones, actually. So I feel very nervous, anxious, and was worried about when can I run back. But eventually, it makes me rethink. I just need to slow down and wait for it to heal. I think after 2 or 3 months, I got back on my feet and I managed to finish a full marathon. And another of my experiences, an event in Vietnam, when I almost got a heat stroke. I was I think almost calling it off already. It was very, very bad because when I was running past the villages in Vietnam, I just go to each and every toilet that the villagers have and I go and cool down myself. Even though they don't speak English, I said, where's your toilet? I go inside the toilet and I go and bathe.
And you still managed to like keep running?
Yeah, until a certain checkpoint when I was just left with 1 hour, I was thinking of calling it off. And lucky to have some other runners, they said, now I just keep moving, just slowly, just keep moving. And eventually, I managed to finish the race. But it was a memorable experience.
Would it be reasonable to say that this same determination and resilience that you have in running these really long distances, has it also applied to how you dealt with the rest of your life? For example, the challenges of the past year?
I think it does more or less, because it's part of my personality, I would say, to finish what you started. I plan it and I love challenges. I plan to finish it at the best that I could. I think that is part of my personality, which contributes to how I deal with life and how I deal with my work as well.
And indeed, it does seem that the same grit and resilience you apply to running has served you well in life. We're going to take a short break. And when we come back, we'll be talking about the burden of shame and stigma that prevents healthcare workers from getting the help they need for mental health issues, as well as the lessons that we can all learn from that. Welcome back to the second half of our episode on mental health of healthcare workers at the front lines. So in the past year, I believe that not only did you have to deal with your own challenges, your own stress, both of you were in positions of leadership as well, right? You had teams working with you and for you. How do you support your colleagues who are also going through the same challenges and the same stress?
I can start, I guess. From my perspective, I think the thing that was most helpful is that we were in a position where we could do something. I think there was a real sense of helplessness in a lot of people when you're dealing with the pandemic, that, you know, there's so much information coming through, you don't know what's going on and all these changes, but we were in a position where we're actually able to do something with our jobs, we've got something to focus on. And I think what really helped at the time was communication, so really clear communication. And that's not just from the bosses down to the more junior staff, but also the other way around. So there was this very clear thing where they set up these online Microsoft Teams meetings where anyone from the department could join in, and they'll be talking about what's the changes, what's happening in Victoria or in Australia in general, and what we're doing. And then there was discussion. It was good for everyone to see that even, you know, the very experienced bosses were having the same concerns as all of us. And that was, I think that really helped as well, just for everyone to know that we're all facing the same fears, we're all trying to deal with the same things as well. And just knowing what was changing and having that option of going. And if it's too much, sometimes it's too much communication, it can get really overwhelming as well. So there was also really a sense of trying to make sure that everyone was like, work time versus personal time was very important, because you get into this cycle of you've got a WhatsApp group for work that's just constantly on, constantly updating. And if you don't mute it and say, I'm clocking off now, I'm not going to read anymore, you just get into this cycle, this constant bombardment of information and then information on social media about what's going on from the news as well, and just gets a bit too much. So clear communication, but also a clear separation, I think, of time off and time on with work. And then having time off, I think, Trevor, you mentioned you'd worked like nonstop with not a lot of days off. In our hospital, we were lucky in the sense that we didn't have to have that sort of situation. And a lot of people did already have leave booked in, because you have to put in your leave request at the start of the year. So you've already got leave booked in, and we were encouraged, even though we couldn't do anything, we were in lockdown and stuck at home, encouraged to still take the time off even during that time, so that no one was burnt out at the start and you weren't getting into a state where everyone was just working too hard and getting too stressed out. So we were actually encouraged to just take our leave and try and just get some time off.
It's very, very different, you know. At the very beginning of the pandemic, we already received letters saying that our leave is frozen.
Yeah, I think my friends in the UK are in the same boat. Like, immediately everyone's leave was cancelled. They were put onto different rosters, you know, pulled into a different specialty because you have to cover a different area. And so there was a lot of that, I think, in other countries as well. So we're very fortunate, I think, in Australia that we never really faced. Like, we had a little bit of a second wave in Victoria, but really not anything that you guys or my friends back in the UK were facing. And that's definitely, I think, having time off is really hard when you're in that situation. But also just making sure you have time off outside of work where you switch off. I think that's hard to do.
Earlier in the episode, we talked about how one of the ways people cope with stressful situations is to compartmentalize. And I think doctors do that a lot. They don't bring their work home. They try and switch off as much as they can when they go home. And since the pandemic started, a lot of healthcare workers have not been able to do that. It's just been on all the time just to keep up with conditions that keep changing. Now, for a little bit to add about the clear communication bit. From my own experience, since the pandemic started, there's been a lot of information passed down from upper and middle management. Sometimes I would say indiscriminately, and there's so many memos, so many guideline updates, so many SOPs that it becomes overwhelming to the point that nobody reads because there's just too much and the information does not get through to the lower ranks. So one of the ways that I suggested to my management was to filter or only send important memos while the rest are just like daily or weekly highlights of things that are really, really important and that we really need to know. Now, for those who listen to episode 7 of Mind Brew Chats, Minimalism and Mental Health, you would have heard about my deep, deep hatred of WhatsApp chat groups. So I only keep those that are very, very necessary. But yes, clear communication is important because it cultivates a sense of security as well, because everyone knows what's going on, what they need to do. And that's really important for psychological safety. I mean, it's good for your mental health.
Major part of keeping, I guess, doctors in general healthy. I think emergency doctors in particular have a dark sense of humor. I think that's how we survive our jobs. So I think the WhatsApp groups, I know you hate, but it was actually very useful because we do have a WhatsApp group that's just, you know, the registrar, I guess, the same level of training, junior medical staff, and it's more fun things, complaining about stuff and jokes. So that was useful, just, you know, to let off steam as well. So you're not constantly just talking about COVID day and night. So humor always helps get you through. I think that was important. The one last thing I think with supporting juniors is mentorship. I don't know if that's a big thing back in Malaysia, but it's something that we've been pushing a lot more to formalize, to have a mentor at work that's someone that you're not, that your career is not reliant on. So not involved as your boss, but just as a mentor. So nothing you talk to your mentor about will get to your boss or anyone else. It's just a confidential thing. They're there to support you and give you advice and all that. So that I think is useful, and that carried on during the pandemic as well. And I think that was helpful for a lot of trainees or doctors to talk through how things were going in a confidential way, even if they weren't able to access other supports, because we talked about, you know, people struggling with actually being willing to seek help. But that's one of the areas where it's more formalized and everyone has a mentor that you're assigned to in our hospital, and so you have someone that you can talk to.
Just to clarify, this was started way before,
yeah.
Do we have a similar system in leisure travel, or is it more like an informal system?
I think it's an informal system. We have a mentorship program as well, but the thing is, this is for preparation to when to go to the master's program. And the mentorship now is a bit complicated because of our contract system. So a lot of contract officers are not able to pursue in what they like in the other specialties. That really frustrates a lot of them, and a lot of uncertainties actually.
And that uncertainty is a major contributor to stress for contract healthcare workers who are in the Malaysian healthcare system now, including doctors, pharmacists, nurses, dentists, and others as well. Now, both Amelia and Trevor have talked extensively about how resistant doctors are, or generally just healthcare workers, how resistant we are towards seeking help for a mental health condition. And logically, this shouldn't be the case, because as healthcare professionals, we are trained and we know in theory that mental health issues are normal, mental health disorders are treatable, and you get more positive outcomes the earlier that you intervene. In addition to that, we also have easier access to healthcare systems in comparison to the general public. So why are we still so resistant to getting help for a mental health condition? Whereas for a physical condition, we probably wouldn't be so ashamed of it. We are going to dive deep into this issue and compare the state of mental health stigma among healthcare workers in Australia, Malaysia, and in the UK, since Amelia has some experience there. Amelia, you've told me before that you had so much to say about this subject. So please go ahead.
Try not to rant. So it's an area that I am passionate about because I have personal experience with it. I have lots of friends who suffer with mental health problems as well. And I've seen it amongst, I guess, colleagues here in Australia, back in the UK, also back home in Malaysia. So I think the stigma around mental health is still very, very strong. Things have changed a lot in the last, probably the last, you know, 5-10 years, definitely changing and changing for the better, but there's still so much to do in terms of getting the stigma, reducing the stigma around mental health. I think the stigma in general from a public perspective, and also the stigma in general in healthcare workers as well. So from a healthcare worker perspective, as you say, we are in the business of, you know, we're supposed to be the ones who care for people. We're supposed to be the ones who understand that mental health is an illness that's treatable. But we are just the worst patients, I think, as doctors and healthcare workers. I can tell you how to treat someone for depression and anxiety and all that. But when it comes to myself or my friends or colleagues, we just struggle so hard to actually say, I need help and I have a problem. And a lot of it is just our own perspectives, our own, you know, fears and insecurities around what mental health and mental illness is about. And part of that will be, you know, upbringing, your cultural background, your religious background also plays a big part in it. And I think growing up in Kuching, don't think anyone really talked about mental health at any point when we were growing up. We knew there was the mental hospital where people got locked up was the perspective. And then, you know, sometimes you hear rumors about people going crazy or, you know, acting weird and it disappear. But there was never really any talk about what mental illness or mental health and looking after your mental health should be and how it should be treated and where to seek help. So growing up around that sort of situation, it's not something that you then are conscious about until you actually go out, experience it, learn about it yourself and are educated about it. So I mentioned before, I've struggled with depression for a long time. So it's always been something that's difficult for me, and it's always scary to talk about in an open forum as well. I think I like to think I'm open about mental health, but I'm also aware that this is going out into a public space. You know, someone that knows me will hear me talking about this. Like, it's kind of silly things that you worry about, and you know that it's not going to affect you, but you still worry. And there's all this silly things that we tell ourselves when we're working as a doctor. You know, I'm the only one that's struggling with this. I'm not coping with my job. I'm not managing my emotions. Why isn't anyone else struggling like me? I feel like I'm the only one who's like this. I can't go into work. I don't feel like I'm doing my job well, and this is my problem. So there's a lot of this going on, and it's a lot of it's not based in reality. You know, you think, oh, if I admit I need help, my boss will think I'm weak, that someone else will get a job next time when I reapply for a job, I'm not going to get it. It'll affect my training, and then go my records, whatever this record means. So there's a lot of our own perspective kind of feeding into it. But the reality is that if, say, my colleague came to me and this, or I knew that my colleague was having mental health issues, the reality is, would you then go spreading rumors about them or say, oh, you know, so-and-so is crazy or is not dealing with whatever? It's not something we actually in reality would do. Like, you think about your colleagues, they wouldn't do that. Like, most of the people who work in healthcare, I would like think are caring, empathetic in general, and not that sort of behavior, I don't think in reality would come up. But there's still this perception that you have in your head when you are struggling with mental health problems, that you can't seek help because how will people look at me? And then there's this whole thing about confidentiality that doctors are paranoid about as well. In the UK, they've done quite a lot of work around getting rid of this problem by setting up special mental health services for healthcare workers. And that's a separate service. You don't have to go to a GP or a referral from a doctor. You can just self-refer. And they've set up all these things around confidentiality where you can look at the doctors or mental health workers that you're going to speak to or see, and you can select the one. So it's a very small, I guess it's a small country, and you might come across people that you end up working with or have worked with before. So there's some grounds to the paranoia, I guess, that you could see someone for your mental health and then the next week you'll be working with them in a professional capacity. So they've worked around that by giving this service. So it's I think mostly in England, I'm not sure about Scotland or the rest of the UK, and where they've set up this service where you can register under a pseudonym if you want, if you don't want your full name, and none of your records will have your actual name on it. So it's a registration number, and then all the records are like that. So helps with their paranoia about seeking help, but also shows you how worried doctors are around confidentiality, even though we know that, you know, if a patient came to us with mental health problems, we're not allowed to discuss it with someone else, like, unless there was a reason to. But that's a big thing in trying to seek help.
That's really interesting about that service, that's especially for, is it just for doctors or does it include other allied health, like nurses or pharmacists?
I believe it's other healthcare workers as well. I'm not sure the exact scope of it, but I know it's more than just doctors.
Yeah. It is impressive, but it also makes me sad at the same time. In Malaysia, when you register with a psychiatry clinic, you get a red card. So that alone makes you distinctive. And even myself, after working in this field for so many years, when I was dealing with depression, I went private. I didn't want my name to appear in the public healthcare system. The thing is, like you said, those whispers in my head may or may not have been grounded in reality, but they were real to me. And I didn't want to walk into a clinic and see someone that I could potentially be working with professionally. The thing is, if we continue to hide it, if we continue to treat mental health and seeking help for a mental health condition like a dirty little secret, it's never, never going to be normalized. And that makes me sad. Trevor, what was the situation like in Malaysia? Is it similar to what I've been describing, what Emily has been describing, or do you have a different kind of experience?
I think in Malaysia, it's getting, people are more and more aware of mental health illnesses now, and I think the stigmatization is getting less, but not at a very, very fast rate at the moment. I think people still need more understanding, and I think a lot of people experience it, but they do not know how to express it, and they are still very secretive about their own illnesses. So we still need a lot of time in Malaysia to reached a mature period or mature stage at the moment, and I'm not sure whether we have enough resources for mental health services at the moment. I myself also experienced depression when I was serving in a district hospital, because it's just working and that's about it. And it's a toxic environment at the point of time, and I don't know who to turn to, actually. I don't know what can I do, but if eventually I volunteered and joined the medical camp, and it really helps me after the volunteer activity with the NGO. So I feel volunteering helps because it takes you out of your current work or current school, and you meet more people from different field, and you talk to people, and you are contributing without expecting anything back in that sense, which I think it helps in the long run if you volunteer. That's my personal experience.
I think it really helps to have both of both Dr. Trevor, Dr. Emily sharing your experiences here, because it's very evident that if you are a doctor, if you are a healthcare worker, a pharmacist, a nurse or whatever, and you are going through episodes of depression, anxiety or burnout, you are not alone. It's not a personal failing. It doesn't mean that you are weak, and you can get help for it. Now, I think that part of the stigma of having a mental health condition is that generally society cannot differentiate between the person and the illness. Say if a doctor has depression or has anxiety, how does that affect your perception of their ability to function, of their competency? What do you think about that?
Yeah, I agree. I think people often find it difficult to separate the mental illness from the person. It's hard to understand. I get where it comes from, because there's so much stigma around it, but you know, there's a lot of work around changing the language about how we talk about people with mental health problems, similar to how we talk about people with physical problems. So people hate to be called the heart attack patient, for example, you know, so we don't refer to people as the depressed patient in bed, whatever, or the psychotic patient or schizophrenic patient. So it's trying to change people's the way people think about mental illness as an illness, as you would think, like, I've got asthma, it's a condition that I have to manage. I've got, you know, high blood pressure, and it's a condition I have to manage for the rest of my life. And mental illness often is something that you have to work on for a longer term as well. Even if you recover, there's often periods where you slip back in and out of it. And so it's changing that mentality of, oh, this is my one big thing that's affecting me, and this defines me as a person. I'm now a depressed person, and you know, just everyone looks at me differently, and you look at yourself differently in that way as well. So it's just changing that mindset and perception. It's very bizarre to think about it, but you know, looking at doctors and seeking help back in the UK, I had so many people say to me, like, oh, you know, I felt so bad. I really needed time off work. That I thought about, you know, just getting into an accident, getting a physical injury that would allow me to have time off, but could not admit that I have a mental health problem that I need time off for. So it's okay to break your leg and be treated for that and have time off. And that's a really sad state of affairs, but very, very common. And so it just goes to show how people look at mental health as such a separate thing from just your health in general, which really is around the stigma that we're still working on. I guess it's a work in progress for everyone. Yeah.
And the thing is, when you really think about it, the consequences of you having a mental health condition and not getting treated for it because you're not asking for help are actually far more dangerous than, you know, having the mental health condition itself. Because, well, injuring yourself on purpose, number one, just to get off work, just so that you can feel you have a legit reason to call in sick. But in terms of patient care as well, the patient care suffers, the quality of your work suffers, there is an increased risk of medication errors, and all of these things. So seeking help is really important. It's really important to know that there is no shame, and you can do it. I would like to hear your opinions on this quote that I read today. There was an editorial on physician burnout in the COVID pandemic on Vox, and it said that medicine actually attracts people who are predisposed to having mental health conditions because they are high achievers, they are perfectionists, and when that happens, it leads to a stigma in medicine to getting help, to asking for help, to admitting it all that you need help. Because emotions, struggling, are an imperfection. And medicine is a field of perfection. What do you think of this statement? Does it resonate with you at all?
Medicine is definitely not a field of perfection. I think the longer you work in it, you realize it's there's no perfection in there. But there's a lot of truth in that statement, I think. I think if you look at the statistics, I think it's like 1 in 4 or something of doctors will have mental health problems at some stage of their career. That's pretty high. And you're right, there's a lot of type A perfectionists, high achievers who end up in medicine because you've gone through your early life, you know, passing tests, never really failing anything, and just, you know, top scorer, getting all the prizes, and you're used to being at the top of your field, whatever that is. And then you go into medicine and suddenly you're confronted with this situation where, you know, there is no certainty in medicine. There's no 100%, this is the cure, this is. So there's a lot of uncertainty. You're dealing with patients and lives, and suddenly it just becomes a lot. And then people see mental health problems as a personal failure. So they look at it as they are not coping, I'm not coping. Whereas it's really, you're in a challenging situation. Anyone would struggle. And if you talk to all of your peers, you probably realize that most people are struggling as well, but just everyone is in their own kind of, I'm struggling, no one else is struggling situation. And so I would agree that there's a lot of that, like the predisposition, yes, and then the type of career you're in then is high pressured. There's a lot of hoop jumping and next steps in training and what you need to do next that you need to focus on. So there's a lot of that as well that builds into, I can't fail, I can't take time off.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of, when we started our career as a doctor, right, because we are top scorer, high achievers, then medicine is dealing with people's lives. So we tend to be perfectionists and we tend to want to do the right thing and try to save as many lives as we can. But the more you are in this field, you know that there's only so much that you can do to save lives, and sometimes saving lives doesn't mean it's better actually. So depends on situation and the context you are in actually.
How supportive has the system around you been? I'm interested to see if there were any changes that you saw pre and post COVID in terms of support, mental health support specifically for healthcare workers.
I'm not very sure in Sabah, but I know there's a with mental health psychosocial support in place now, and they are doing a tremendous job, I think, because they really call a lot of patients, a lot of person under investigation, close contact to follow up their mental health status. But I'm not sure about the healthcare workers, whether they put much attention compared to all these patients and all these close contacts. Also, I'm not sure about the efficacy or the results that from this program. I'm personally never been caught by any of this psychosocial support. But if I were to be caught, I will feel agitated and annoyed when I'm working, I think. So yeah, I think different people sees this psychosocial support differently. And maybe it's not a thing for me, but maybe it's a thing for somebody else. That's why I said this mental health help need to be personalized and need to be tailored accordingly.
To clarify, I think the MHPSS services, they normally call people who are in quarantine or who have been diagnosed positive. They wouldn't call any random person. They just don't have the capacity for it. One of the things that they do is provide psychological first aid, which by itself doesn't just mean mental health support, but also asking, you know, what are the things that you need? Do you, for example, if you're quarantined by yourself, do you need food? Do you need someone to take care of your child? Do you need some medicine? Do you need, I don't know, do you need some arrangements to be made for your family or for your job? You know, mental health support is not just, you know, someone talking to you, counseling, giving you medication, etc. It's also about providing safety, psychological safety, security, in terms of, you know, that things are being taken care of. You know that you have enough food, you have a place to stay. You don't have to worry about these things. I'm not sure about the uptake among healthcare workers as well. I do know that these services exist in most major hospitals and in most states, but I would be really interested to see, like what you said, what's the efficacy of it? What I know, what's the outcome and what's the uptake really? Because like Amelia said, you know, confidentiality is a huge worry. How do we overcome that barrier in terms of getting doctors and other healthcare workers to actually seek help? What about you, Emily? Have you seen that any changes pre and post COVID? Has there been more improvements, or, you know, things were generally good before, so the systems that are already running are doing as well now?
I wouldn't say things are generally good. They're definitely better, I think, than what's available in Malaysia, but it's encouraging to know that that psychosocial support is in place for at least the people who are in quarantine. So the services we have in place prior to the pandemic were the usual kind of workplace supports and the external organizations that might be statewide. There are also separate doctor specific services as well. And there's quite a lot of resources that you can access if you want to, but again, not sure about the uptake. With COVID, then there was a lot of emphasis in terms of trying to prevent mental health problems early on. So there were a lot of initiatives at the start because we were looking at potentially a really bad situation happening. So they did bring in actually our mental health team to talk to the doctors, have a session, and then try and encourage people to seek help early was the push. But I don't know that there was a lot of uptake with that. There were a lot of well-being initiatives that were a bit hit or miss. You know, the last thing I want to do is to be doing yoga before I start work or something like that. But, you know, there's always those things that people set out to try and just keep people doing other things to keep yourself healthy mentally. But there wasn't really a massive change in terms of the support services. I think I did do, like you mentioned before, about surveys with the burnout type. They did do like a mental health survey at the start to see how things progress towards the end of the pandemic. Well, there's no end, but through the pandemic. But again, it's hard to know how much people actually participate. I haven't seen any results from that. But there's definitely more publicity or information about where you could seek help. Was a lot more in the public space for all the healthcare staff in hospital. And I think that's one thing that probably has improved with the pandemic is there's a lot of emphasis on where you can seek help from a mental health perspective, just in general for the public as well. It's not, I think that helps tie into, you know, reducing stigma around it, because then everyone knows that if you're struggling, this is where you seek help and this is the line they can call if you're really in crisis. Whereas often you really don't know where to go. I think sometimes back in Malaysia, I remember when I was there and struggling, no idea who to call or what to do. I'm just like in my own little world going, I'm really struggling. But you know, who do I speak to, or where do I find support?
I believe that the situation has somewhat improved since then. There are a lot more services, both in the private and the public sector, and including the NGO sector as well. So the awareness, the information going out there is more than was before, but there are still people who are either completely in the dark or still unable to overcome that fear and that stigma of potentially being identified with or labeled with a mental health disorder. In an ideal world, if money and time and politics was an issue, what measures do you hope to see put in place? Let's talk specifically about caring for the mental health of healthcare workers, of doctors. Like, you've talked so much about how hard it is to get doctors to seek help, even though the rate of burnout is so high. So in an ideal world, what do you want to see happen?
I wish I had the answers. I think that would be, it would be nice to have a solution. I think the one big thing I would say is access to mental health services is still a problem. I think even in Australia, we see it every day in hospital, in the community, that, that actual access to mental health support is still difficult. And I imagine it's the same elsewhere. And there's just not enough, I guess, funding. So if in an ideal world, that would be, you know, specific mental health services, rather than you're in crisis, you have to go to an emergency department where it's noisy, it's traumatic, and you're in a bad mental state already. In an ideal world, that wouldn't be the case, but that's my perspective. And then really, I don't know what the solution is about normalizing, talking about mental health, looking after mental health as just a normal thing. You know, you don't have to have a diagnosis of depression or whatever to actually have mental health problems and need support and help just in terms of managing that. I think that's, a lot of people think, oh, you know, I've never had a big trauma in my life. I don't have a reason to be depressed. I don't really, like, you don't have to justify how you're feeling or how you're struggling. It doesn't have to be a big reason to suddenly then cause you, like, things can happen and tip you over the edge into a difficult state, but you don't have to justify it to yourself or anyone else. Different people struggle with different things, and it doesn't mean that your problem is less of a problem than anyone else's. So I think, I don't know what the solution is about normalizing it, but in an ideal world, someone would go to a GP and go to a psychologist or a counselor or a mental health support person in the same way without, you know, I've got to hide this situation that I'm seeking help for. Yeah.
Many people don't realize that mental health is a spectrum. So exactly what you just said, they think that, oh, you know, it is not going to happen to me. It can't. I have a good life. Nothing's really happened. Or they have just never really thought about it before, and then suddenly it happened. But mental health is a spectrum, and all of us will move through the entire spectrum throughout our lives, from 100% healthy to the other extreme, which is of the spectrum, which is when you have a mental health disorder, which maybe lands you in a clinic or a hospital. All of us will move back and forth along that spectrum, hopefully not to the point where it gets to a mental health disorder. But the thing is, everyone will move through that spectrum. Unless, there's a caveat, unless you move, you live your entire life blind, deaf, numb, like a robot, without feeling anything at all. That is the condition for never having a mental health issue. And that's not who we are. We are living, breathing, feeling human beings. Mental health conversations need to be normalized. People need to understand that it's as important as physical health. It's something that we can and must seek help for once we realize that something's not quite right. And not when, oh no, I can't get out of bed today to go to work. At that point, it's probably a little bit too late. So the moment that you realize something is wrong, talk to someone, educate yourself, and get help. Now, Trevor, in an ideal world, in an ideal Malaysia, what measures do you think can be done to help our healthcare workers stay mentally healthy in service?
I think we need to provide enough access at the moment first, because I think we need to train like more psychologists. I don't think there's many psychologists in our Ministry of Health at the moment. Ministry of Health need to see it as, we need to start from our own body, from our own ministry, to provide enough access for our own healthcare workers before we can expand it to the public. I think we need to see it as mental illness as is as common as a simple flu or fever or so, and the access has to be there for us to tap in. If not, things will get worse and it may be more severe. But I think we still need more specialists or more workers in this mental health field.
For me, I will have a completely different take on that, on this issue of how to tackle the issue of mental health access. I would say that rather than waiting and training more and more professionals, which is expensive and it takes too long, I would, in an ideal world, in an ideal Malaysia, the government needs to invest very heavily into schools, into education, into teaching, resilience skills, mental health, education and literacy right from the start, so that when these children grow up to be adults and functioning members of society, they know how to take care of their mental health, they know how to seek for help, and they don't progress to that state where they need professional interventions, because they have been trained all their lives to be emotionally resilient, to have the coping skills that need, etc., etc. So that's actually my take on this issue. And with that, we've come to the end of episode 8 of Mind Brew Chats. Now, if you follow us on social media, and if you have not, you really should. It's at MindBrewKCH, at MindBrewKCH on Facebook and Instagram. You would have noticed that our episode poster is not its usual vibrant yellow. It's black and white, and for a good reason. We are supporting a social media campaign with the hashtags that you also see on our episode poster. Hashtag CodeBlackMY, hashtag BlackMondayMY, hashtag SaveMyContractHCW, which stands for Save My Contract Healthcare Worker. I'm going to let Dr. Trevor explain in brief what that social media campaign is about.
Thank you, Laura. This Code Black campaign is referring to a campaign which is brought up by Malaysian Medical Association. Code Black refers to a hospital emergency denoting a threat to personnel or suspicious or bomb threat. And at this moment, the contract healthcare workers situation in Malaysia is a ticking time bomb, actually. So if it explodes, it will affect the lives of all Malaysians, because the healthcare system of Malaysia is at stake here. Our healthcare services, the quality service that has sustained over the past six decades since Merdeka, will be affected. Because these contract healthcare workers, they don't have the job security, they don't have the similar opportunity as the other permanent officers, not only for doctors, as well as for other healthcare professionals like the nurses, the medical assistant, as well as pharmacists and dentists. So this is a campaign that I'm standing by this campaign in order for the Ministry of Health and also the government to take action to rectify this as soon as possible, so that we don't need to suffer in the future.
Where can people find out more about this campaign?
You can find out more on MMA Scoremore's Facebook page.
I'll be adding the link to the MMA Scoremore's Facebook page in the show notes, so please make sure that you go over there, even if you are not a healthcare worker, but you would like to educate yourself and to spread awareness about this important campaign that is currently happening on social media with the hashtags BlackMondayMY and hashtag SaveMyContractHCW. Please go over to the Facebook page and educate yourself. For any last words that you would like to share with our listeners, Emilia Trevor, anything from your personal experiences that you would like our listeners to take away?
I think from myself, I think I would just advise, take care of yourself first before take care of anybody else. So I think you are the most important before you're providing your healthcare service to others. So thanks, Laura, again for inviting me.
The one important thing I would say as a takeaway is that to remember that having a mental health problem or mental health illness does not mean that you can't have a rich and rewarding career. And as Trevor said, just seeking help for yourself and what you mentioned before about noticing early and seeking help early rather than waiting to get into a bad situation, I think that's important. So talk about it more, talk to other people, and just normalize talking about mental health. And that's for everyone, not just for healthcare workers. Thanks, Laura, for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you, Emilia and Trevor, for that wonderful conversation that we just had. It takes courage to be vulnerable, and I'm so grateful that the two of you were able to share that vulnerability with us tonight. And with that, it's a wrap, and we'll see you on the next episode of Mind Brew Chats.